This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Of the seven wonders of the ancient world, only one remains, and that is the Great Pyramid of Giza. The pyramid stands in the Egyptian desert outside of Cairo. It took decades and an estimated 20,000 people or more to build it way back in 25 to 50 BC. That was well before the era of engine-powered cranes and heavy machinery, when each one of the 2 million blocks used to make it had to be hauled up in the old-fashioned way, lots of muscle. And while the ancient Egyptians left lots of records and hieroglyphics behind, detailing many different aspects of their culture and society, they left no information about how the pyramids were actually built. There is no end to the speculation, though. Over the centuries, Egyptologists have been debating the construction methods ever since. And now, make room for one more theory. My next guest thinks he may finally know the secret to the construction of the Great Pyramid. And he details the new theory in a new book co-authored with the French architect who first proposed it. Joining me now to talk more about it is Bob Breyer. He is co-author with Jean-Pierre Houdin of The Secret of the Great Pyramid, How One Man's Obsession Led to the Solution of Ancient Egypt's Greatest Mystery. He is an Egyptologist and mummy expert and senior research fellow at Long Island University. He's here with us in New York. Thank you for coming with us today.
Pleasure, Ira.
What are the standard theories about how the pyramid was built?
Well, for 30 years I've been teaching the basic theory and always knew it was wrong. It's the single...
You knew it was wrong when you were teaching.
Yep, I did. And I told the students, you know, this is the best theory we have, but there are real problems. The best theory was the single ramp theory. The idea is, how do you get blocks up to the top of a 480-foot pyramid? And it's the old Hollywood solution, one big long ramp with guys hauling on blocks.
Right.
But we always knew there were real problems with it. I mean, if you're going to have a slope going up to 480 feet in the air, it's got to be a very long, gentle slope. And it would have to be a mile long. And that's just too big. You can't have anything that big.
And so your idea is that there's an internal ramp we can't see from the outside.
Yeah, the secret of the Great Pyramid is really that there's a ramp inside. It's a mile long, like a road in a parking garage, you know, sort of corkscrewing up, and it's been in there for 4,500 years.
Wow. And so did they use the ramp as part of the pyramid itself?
Yeah, the pyramid is its own ramp, and you've got this thing going up inside it, and the blocks for the very top are brought up inside the pyramid.
And how were you able to see this ramp if you can't get inside to see it?
Well, the unfortunate thing is we haven't seen it yet. It's a theory, but it's more than a theory. There's evidence for it too, but so far we just don't have the smoking gun.
Mm-hmm. What would you need to actually see it? Is it possible to actually take a picture of it internally? We have all these high-tech radar, infrared, all kinds of these cameras that can see through the earth, through opaque objects. Could we see the ramp if we wanted to?
Yeah, in a way, we've got a picture already. It's a curious story. In 1986, a French team went to the pyramid and did a very sophisticated survey using microgravimetrics. It lets you find low-density areas in the pyramid. They're looking for hidden chambers. And in 1986, they found a little hidden chamber with sand inside. Not a great discovery, but something. But they should have found this internal ramp, and they didn't say anything about it. And then when Jean-Pierre Houdin was talking about his theory, gave a lecture, one of the guys was there, and he said to him, I've got something you're going to be very happy to see. And he took him to his office in Paris, and the computer printed out the internal ramp. They had found it in 1986, but they just didn't know what to make of it, and they ignored it. They thought it was an artifact of the computer.
So then Jean-Pierre said what?
Incredible. I mean, that's exactly what he said.
Incroyable.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. And then we knew, you know, he knew it really looked good. So that's why I say that it's not really just a theory. Yeah. There's evidence for it. But to answer your question, Ira, there are other ways to get at this thing. We could use infrared photography. You could use ground-penetrating radar. And we're really looking for another confirmation of the theory pretty soon.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Bob Breyer, co-author of The Secret of the Great Pyramid, How One Man's Obsession Led to the Solution of Ancient Egypt's Greatest Mystery. You know, this being the Middle East, I'm sure that the greatest impediment to you getting in there has got to be political, right? Yeah, or religious or social or something like that.
No,
it's not going to be the science.
No, it's not the science. Science isn't our problem. We know what to do. We know how to do it. And it's not too hard.
Mm-hmm. What would you do?
Okay. We would use, I think, infrared photography first. That's a really good mm-hmm. thing. Thermal cameras can give you a really good picture.
It can penetrate inside the big stones.
No problem. The ramp isn't all the way deep inside the pyramid. It's near the surface. It's only about 15 feet in. So it's not going to have to be a real deep penetrating thing. We could do it. And we have to make a permission. You know, we have to give a sort of proposal to the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and we need their permission. And we haven't gotten the permission yet, but I think within a year or so we will get it. We've got to wait for other people to do their projects on the pyramid. All kinds of egos have to be stroked, but I think we're going to get the permission.
Mm-hmm. And give us the story. You talked to Huda about this, and take it from there. What happened after that?
Sure. There's really two stories to this tale. One is the pyramid story and how it was built. The other is Jean-Pierre Houdin, and I'm not sure which is the more amazing one. Houdin is an outsider. He came to my house one day with his laptop and wanted to show me his theory. And when I say he's an outsider, he's not an Egyptologist. He's an architect who 8 years ago gave up a successful practice as an architect, sold his apartment, moved into a one-room flat with his laptop, and for 8 hours a day did nothing but computer-generated graphics of the inside of the Great Pyramid. And, you know, he emerged with the theory, you know, the internal ramp theory. And he's just an outsider. He had no idea of Egyptology. He had never been to the pyramid. You know, when he came to my house and he showed me these beautiful diagrams, you know, I said to him, well, what'd you think when you first saw the pyramid? And he said, oh, I've never been there. You know, and we were all shocked.
You didn't show him the door at that point.
We didn't, because this guy was clearly the real deal. He knew the pyramid better than anyone I had ever met. You know, but the other kicker is he didn't want to see the pyramid. You know, I said, don't you want to see it? No, I know what it looks like. And that was it. He didn't want to go. I finally dragged him, but I was kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm. And so he got to see the pyramid, and he said, that's my baby there, and I know what's inside.
Yeah, but you know what was disappointing? Yeah. He didn't go crazy when he saw it. It was sort of like this very nonchalant, yeah, it's kind of like what I thought.
Well, he's been looking at it for years, right?
Yes, yes.
It's better in my head than what I'm seeing here.
Yeah, it's like that beautiful woman, you know, on the radio. You don't want to see her, right?
And so what happens next?
Well, next we went through Egypt looking for other evidences that might support the theory. And you know, it was kind of interesting going with him because he really had interesting insights. So we went to a ruined pyramid that had an internal ramp, a small one, nothing like the Great Pyramid. But we could look at that and say, at least the Egyptians were building internal ramps. They had that technique. So we were looking for things to support the theory.
Doesn't that make sense if you were to think about making a pyramid today in a very simple way, that you would put the ramp inside so that you wouldn't have to go away for a mile away and haul that stuff up there and drop the stones off as you go around the circle?
It makes sense now that the guy came up with the theory, but for 200 years nobody said, well, here's the way to do it. I mean, it was that he was an outsider, that he didn't have all this Egyptological baggage. He could just sort of think it through as an architect and say, well, the inside determines the outside. Let's think about the inside.
And what does the government of Egypt say about all of this?
Not much. There's no
Are
real
they fearful of it, that you're coming in with an outside idea and might upset something?
I don't think so. No, I don't think it's that. I think if anything, you know, if we really discover this internal ramp and show it, it'll be great for tourism. You know, everybody's going to be talking about the pyramids. Everybody want to go. So I don't think they're fearful in that way. It's more sort of social, political, who's going to go at the pyramid first, you know, who's going to make another discovery. So we just got to wait in line.
Why is it that we don't have any documentation from the Egyptians who were used to do all this kind of documentation, not about the pyramid?
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, the Egyptians were really a nation of accountants. They wrote down everything,
right.
You know. I mean, I can tell you the name of Ramses the Great's two horses, right? Mutas Content and Victory in Thebes were their names. I can tell you how many people were killed in various battles. But they never wrote down a single technique for construction. We don't have anything architectural from them. Maybe it was a kind of Masonic, you know, secret that this was our industry. I don't know, but they never wrote it down.
Maybe they thought it was just so obvious.
Yeah.
You know, you got to write this down. You take a ramp, you go around and drop the rocks
off.
Yeah,
isn't it obvious? Sure.
It's not obvious to everybody else. You know, you're not going to tell anybody how to make a pile of sand.
Right.
Same shape, different construction from the inside. Well, this doesn't take much brain. So where do you go from here now? Do you just try to get those permits or the meetings with Egypt?
We're really looking for the permissions and to really get the final, you know, conclusive proof. It's also another question, you know, you're asking a pyramid question in a way. Mm-hmm. It's also a Jean-Pierre question. Where does he go from here? I mean, he's really obsessed. He has no other life than the pyramid. I mean, he's a dear friend, but that's all he talks about. And now he's talking about part two.
Part two is
whatever
what?
That may be.
He hasn't told you.
I have no idea.
Is he thinking of another pyramid? Are there other pyramids there?
Not for him.
Not for him.
No, he's a one-man, he's a one-pyramid man. He's thinking about maybe other chambers in the pyramid, perhaps, or other things to be found.
Mm-hmm. And this is, and as you say, in the Secret of the Great Pyramid, this is one man's obsession.
A real obsession. You know, when I first told him about his, I used the word obsession, he said, Bob, in the book, can't we say passion? You know? And I said, no, we'll use obsession.
Every time, any chance you get, he pulls somebody over and talks about.
Oh, yeah. He has no other interest, really.
Mm-hmm. And he'll be greatly does he think he'll live long enough to actually get the opportunity to probe it?
He has no doubt. He has no doubt. People have asked me, are you 100% sure about this theory? I'd say I'm 75% sure. I think the guy's right, but I'm not certain. He's 100% sure. He's going to take that walk a mile up inside the pyramid in that ramp.
1-800-989-8255 before the break. Alex in Washington, D.C. Hi.
Hi, great show. I got a quick question. I read somewhere when they built the replica of the pyramids in Las Vegas, it took them 5 years, and they're one-third the height of the actual pyramids right now, and that's with modern equipment. So I still don't understand how they could have built this in 20 years back, 4,500 years ago.
Good question, Alex. The answer is no unions. It was a different kind of technique, a different structure, but I'll tell you something that will really blow you away, I think. It's 2 million blocks of stone built over 20 years. Now, if you do the math, and these guys had a 10-hour workday, that means one block of stone was put in place every 3.5 minutes for 20 years.
Wow.
That's organization.
And you say in your book it was not built by slaves.
No, it's free labor. There's no doubt about it.
Tell us how you know that.
Oh, sure. A lot of people pick this up from the Bible.
You know,
they think the Bible tells you the Israelites weren't building pyramids. The Bible says they built the cities of Ramses and Pitom. They were building cities, and they're 1,000 years after the pyramids. So we're sure. We also have graffiti from the workmen. We know that these guys were free laborers, and they took pride in their work. They had work gang names, like Khufu's Drunkards. These are real names of work gangs. So these guys took a kind of pride in it. We even have their village where they lived while building the pyramid. So now we know a lot about these guys.
Wow. We're going to learn more about the building of the pyramid with Bob Breyer, who is Jean-Pierre Houdin, authors of The Secret of the Giant of the Great Pyramid, How One Man's Obsession, and boy, it sounds like a real obsession, led to the solution of ancient Egypt's greatest mystery. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And you could also get us on Second Life and also Twitter, SciFry. You can Twitter us a question. We're going to take a short break and be right back, so stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about pyramids with my guest, Bob Breyer. He's an Egyptologist and mummy expert and senior research fellow at Long Island University. His new book, co-authored with Jean-Pierre Houdin, is called The Secret of the Great Pyramid, How One Man's Obsession Led to the Solution of Ancient Egypt's Greatest Mystery. Now, you're a mummy person.
Yes, that's really my
specialty. Is that how you approach the pyramid?
Not at all. That's just my day job. This was sort of an avocation. I became fascinated with this guy and his theory, and I thought he really needed help. So I took a year off from my work to work on pyramids.
But you did some pioneering work on mummification, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a lot of work on mummies. I mean, the thing I'm sort of known for is that about 14 years ago, I took a human cadaver and mummified it in the ancient Egyptian way using ancient tools just to figure out how they did it.
How do they do it?
It wasn't the way people thought. The key to mummification is dehydration. If you can dehydrate the body really quickly, bacteria won't act on it, and it'll last forever. So they took out the internal organs, which are moist, took out the brain through the nose, which is moist, and then dehydrated the body in salts called natron.
It's amazing. I was in Antarctica many years ago in some place called the Dry Valleys. We're going to talk about this a little later in the show. And there was a penguin that had somehow gotten from the coast. And I was with a scientist, and he said, how old do you think that penguin is? I said, a couple of years. He said, it was 10,000 years old. It was lying there in the dry of the desert,
Yeah.
Totally mummified.
Yep, as long as you get rid of that moisture, the thing will remain.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about the pyramid. Let's see if we can go take some phone calls from George in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, George.
Hi. I love your show. I was listening to you about the pyramid, and one of the things that I wanted to mention was that in the construction of the five-pointed stair, the initial triangle that you used to set that up is a isosceles triangle, which is the sides of the pyramid. And side is the golden proportion. The other side is
All right, you'll call back. You're having a senior moment like I do.
Yeah.
Thanks, George.
Is the hyperbolic.
All right, we'll get back to you when you remember, because I have that same sort of problem. Let's go to Glenn in Jackson, Michigan. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, the ramps are really good there. Congratulations on figuring that one out. But you know, you still got to be able to move those blocks. You hear about that concrete engineer out in the Midwest somewhere who's moving 10 and 40-ton blocks single-handedly?
Yeah, I've seen his video. It's pretty impressive. I mean, the guy really has a simple way of moving heavy stones, and I think it shows that it's possible.
How does he do it?
With balance, very careful balance. He can do it with a simple rock, and he's got a balance board, and you put it on, and he just moves it a little bit at a time. It's really quite interesting.
You pick up one box, you stick a round rock under it to act as a fulcrum, and you can, just by putting a tenth of the weight at the other end, walk it across, and you stick another fulcrum under the other end or under the other side of the middle, and you just walk it farther. The nice thing is it only takes about twice the width of the block to move it, which makes turning 90-degree turns on a spiral ramp a lot easier to do.
Yeah, no, I think his real contribution is that you can move fairly heavy objects with very simple techniques.
And very few people.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Glenn.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Tad in Hermiston, Oregon, is it?
Yes, yes.
Hi there.
Good afternoon. I have a question for Mr. Breyer. I'm a thermal infrared guy. I take pictures from the air with thermal infrared cameras. Have found things like pioneer grave sites and pipelines, things like that with it. And I'm just curious, knowing that thermal infrared doesn't penetrate objects, how do you see inside the pyramid?
Well, it's through a temperature differential. What it is the void inside the pyramid, it's going to have a different temperature from the actual stone. So it's based on a temperature differential. And it's been used in archaeology before on buildings, say, in Jerusalem, just to see what's behind walls that you can't use stone walls. So it'll work.
So it's like a shadow that you're going to be.
Yeah, it's not going to be a clear picture.
Yeah. The walls, how thick is the walls?
Yeah. Well, we think it's going to be about, at some place it'll be as thin as perhaps 3 feet where we've gone.
And the ramp itself will be how big?
The ramp is a mile long.
And
it's going to be at least 10 feet wide.
10 feet wide.
Yeah. No, you got to have room for guys to go up and guys to go down, and you've got wide blocks. No, it's a
how,
big
how
ramp.
Wide are the blocks?
The blocks are about 3-foot cubes. 3-foot cubes, but they're on sleds, which increases the width. So you got 10 guys hauling each block.
So we're pretty sure we know how it was made.
Yeah. Yes.
How it was put together.
Yeah. Now we just got to show it's there. The ramp.
Yeah. When is your next opportunity? Are you waiting on something to happen, a response to the government? Or
I think we're going to wait. What we're doing is we're hoping that the book will put a little pressure on people. The interest will be saying, people ask, well, why don't you give these guys permission already? It's non-destructive. We don't even have to touch the pyramid. So there's no reason why we won't get it. And I think we will. We just got to put a little pressure on and let public opinion build behind us.
Well, let's say that you're successful and Jean-Pierre is right. What does that do to the whole world of Egyptology?
I think what it shows is really that the Egyptians were amazing planners. I mean, it doesn't change things radically. Okay, so the ramp is inside rather than outside. But it's a kind of greater feat of planning and engineering that is unheard of in Egypt. So I think it really puts them up a notch again in terms of planning.
Because they're pretty high up already, aren't they?
Oh, they are. They did amazing things. But, you know, it's not rocket science what they did. You didn't need mathematics to build a pyramid. You didn't need, you know, careful theorems. They've never worked out the structural strength of stone, for example. They couldn't calculate how strong stone was. They kept building until the thing broke. Then they knew how strong it was.
And of course, we know the pyramids were there for burial services.
Yes, they
right?
were just tombs. One purpose for the pyramids, to preserve the body of the pharaoh. Mm-hmm.
There was a new pyramid discovered recently. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was found at Saqqara just a week ago or so, and it's really the base of a pyramid. The top of the pyramid is gone, robbed, quarried. You know, they use the stones over and over again in Egypt. But this is an important one. It's a queen's pyramid, and it may have inscriptions in it because it's a later pyramid, so it's important.
It's hard to believe that you can still discover new pyramids.
The belief in Egyptology is that there's more underground than above. You can't believe what's still underground. And, you know, pyramids do disappear. They can be, the say, 18-foot pyramid disappears in the sand, and it's gone.
Wow. And so this was found actually still underground. You say it was the base. It was covered over by the sand.
By sand, yeah, at Saqqara.
Do people still go looking for them as a matter of, let's go look for a pyramid? Or?
Oh, absolutely. There are pyramid experts. I mean, for example, the architect of the first pyramid, the step pyramid at Saqqara, is somebody named Imhotep, and they've been looking for his tomb for 35 years. They know it's in the area, but they just haven't found it yet.
D- Do they line up astrologically to point at stars or planets or anything?
Not really. You know, there was a theory, the
Orion
theory.
Yeah, I know.
Theory.
I remember that.
Yeah,
one.
That's sort of New Age. No, because you
Well, the whole idea about pyramid power is sort of.
Yes, very New Age, or now old age.
But
the pyramids were built one at a time, and the pharaohs didn't work in concert. One guy built his pyramid where he wanted, and the next guy built his pyramid where he wanted. So the big three pyramids at Giza, you know, they look like they line up beautifully.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just where they put them.
And what's the most fascinating aspect of the whole thing to you when you look at a pyramid like that and you say?
I think it's the social organization. When I think about putting one block in place every 3.5 minutes for 20 years.
Around the clock? You think they
10-hour days. 10-hour
days. 10-hour days.
Yeah. I think it's incredible. You had to have 20,000 guys on the pyramid at one time, and they couldn't get in the way of each other.
Right.
And they're hauling the block up a mile-long ramp. Remember, the ramp is a mile long, so they're hauling this thing up a mile. And one guy drops his block off, the next guy has to put his in 3.5 minutes. And they had guys at the quarries. They had thousands of people quarrying the stone. They probably had hundreds of guys just sharpening the chisels. And, for example, part of the pyramid is granite, part is limestone. They knew the different properties of the different stones. And when you get to the burial chamber of the king, it's solid granite. Now, those beams are big. Big, 62 tons, right, some of the beams. They had to start quarrying them 10 years before they needed them to have them ready. So they knew from year one that in year 10 of construction, we're going to want these beams, start quarrying them now. So the planning is what blows me away. I mean, it's not just the size, it's not the beauty, it's this social organization that it was a military operation with surgical precision.
Wow. I never realized that.
Yeah, no, it's incredible.
Every 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, think of it. It's a 2-ton block. Every 3.5 minutes, a block is put in place. And there's no glitches.
Oh. Tell us a little bit more about where they lived. You said there was a town.
Yeah. Yeah, recently, when I say recently, during my lifetime, 20 years ago, they found the workman's village. We knew there had to be a workman's village. These guys lived right near it. You know, they had to have a short commute, walking distance, to the pyramid. And we found the village. And it's very revealing about these guys. You know, before you asked, you sure they're not slaves? They were well cared for. For example, by looking at their bones, we can say they're well mineralized. These guys had good diets. They were given meat, which is a really upper class thing in ancient Egypt, meat. But we look at their spines. We have their burial grounds too. We look at their spines and you can see they had the wear and tear of construction workers. There are discs that are out of place. There are, you know, they had all kinds of construction industries, broken legs, broken, you know, arms. So we can tell a lot. We can almost reconstruct their lives from their village and from their cemetery. So we know a lot about these people.
Fascinating. And if you want to know more about it, this is a great book, The Secret of the Great Pyramid. Getting close to the holidays, you're looking for a good book selection for the holidays. This is a Secret of the Great Pyramid, How One Man's Obsession Led to the Solution of Ancient Egypt's Greatest Mystery. Bob Breyer, one of the co-authors, along with Jean-Pierre Houdin. Bob is here with us. Thank you.
Pleasure,
Thanks
Ira.
For coming down from the Bronx today.
Pleasure, Ira.
We're going to take a short break. Very short, because we're up next, the mysterious bacterial world in your gut. Believe it or not, yes, your guts are filled with bacteria, some good, some bad. They help you digest your food and fight disease, but they can also give you a bad tummy ache or worse. And there is a lot of bacteria in your gut, and now that dark world has just gotten a little less mysterious. Using new techniques developed to catalog the life in soil or in the ocean, researchers have found that our guts are much more diverse than they once thought they were. They've also found that the community of bacteria living in our guts is quite susceptible to a common antibiotic. Joining me now to talk about this is David Relman, professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's also chief of infectious diseases at Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Relman.
It's a pleasure.
Were you surprised by all of this?
I was a bit, yeah. I think we all knew that there were probably many more folks or friends down there than we thought, but the numbers keep growing.
And how I was reading that there are a few pounds of bacteria bugs in our guts.
Yeah, at least a few pounds. And maybe even more sobering is the fact that we're essentially 10 parts microbe, one part human. We have 10 times as many microbial cells in us as we have human cells.
Wow. And so if you add all the people up, How diverse is the colony of bugs in our guts?
Well, we're still trying to figure it out. It looks as though, at least at the distal ends of our gut, down in the colon, we're talking at least a few thousand different strains and species in each of us. And the amazing thing is that each of us is a bit distinct and different from each other.
How do you go about studying all these different species of bacteria and stuff?
Well, historically, it's been largely dependent upon cultivation, growing the bugs in the lab, looking at them and trying to distinguish who they are and what they do. Well, it turns out that cultivation is really not a terribly sensitive method, and we miss almost all of what's actually there just because we don't know how to grow it in the lab. So now we're using sequencing and efforts to pull out bits of sequence DNA and look at the DNA sequence information and say, aha, these are the organisms that must be there because their sequences tell us that that's who they are.
Mm-hmm. And what functions do all these bugs do in our gut?
Well, this is maybe the thing that's a bit surprising to many, and that is they're really providing essential beneficial functions. They're teaching our immune system what to recognize as foreign and foe and what to recognize as friendly. They're helping the development of our gut. They're providing essential nutrition functions, the ability to break down plant material, for example, and absorb calories and nutrients from these complex foods. And finally, they're also protecting us from invasion by disease-causing organisms.
Mm-hmm. Talking with David Relman on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. He's author of a paper that's being published, I guess, this week in the journal Public Library of Science Biology about the guts that live in our gut, the bacteria that live in our guts. What do they do to the immune system? What kind of they attack? Because the guts are considered to be outside the body, right?
Well, it's a bit of a sort of in-between world. The intestinal microbiota, as we refer to it, the bacteria that normally live there, are being constantly sensed by our immune system. And through that sensing, these bacteria, which are there from birth and live with us until death, are basically teaching and instructing our immune system to be constantly on the guard and to also maintain the boundary between us and them. It's an essential beneficial function they're providing. And through that, our immune system then learns when and how to respond when an untoward invader, a disease-causing bacterium, arrives and tries to enter, you know, the previously sacrosanct regions of the body.
You know, whenever we get an antibiotic, our doctors will tell us, watch out, it's going to really hurt you, you know, affect your digestive system. You did test a commonly used antibiotic.
That's right.
And what was it and what did you find?
We picked an antibiotic that we thought would be relatively benign compared to others. It's called ciprofloxacin. Received a lot of press because it was the antibiotic used to protect our postal workers who were at risk for exposure to anthrax back in 2001. And most of them did just fine without untoward side effects. But we know that this and other antibiotics can cause problems at the same time they're being used for, you know, obviously important purposes. Well, so what we did was we asked some human volunteers to take ciprofloxacin for just 5 days. And we collected their poop samples before and during and then well after the exposure. And the result was that something like a third of all the strains and species in the gut were profoundly affected.
Much higher than you expected.
Much higher than we thought. That's right.
One third.
The good news, though, is that by about 4 weeks after exposure, the community had become restored. The numbers of the original organisms had returned, and the community looked more or less as it did before exposure.
Mm-hmm. Can you help restore the bacteria in your gut, the good bacteria, and maybe fight off the bad bacteria, overwhelm them a bit?
Great question. In fact, it's something that is quite on the minds of many people these days, because we'd love to know how to not only anticipate problems, but prevent problems. And, of course, one of the strategies, as you suggest, is the idea of deliberately ingesting live organisms that, that either may be a part of the normal healthy communities or will somehow prompt the community to maintain the proper numbers? Well, I think the answer is it makes sense, and it probably can be done, but I don't think we're smart enough right now to know exactly how best to do it.
All right, I'm going to hold your thought right there and talk more about this because you know people are going to want to know what to buy in the store to do
exactly.
this. Yeah. Stay with us. We'll be right back after we take this short break and talk more about bacteria. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Dr. David Relman, professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford. We're talking about a paper published about what bacteria in your guts are like and what role they play. And I mentioned before we left, you know, a lot of people want to know how to replenish or put good bacteria back in. And I think Eugene in Kansas City I think I pushed the wrong button. Christine in San Francisco is on the phone. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. This is a great topic. A couple of months ago, I got a really bad case of pneumonia, and they gave me antibiotics, and my gut felt very different right after I got out of the hospital. So I started taking some yogurt preparations that they sell in the store,
right.
Because people were telling me you want to avoid getting other kind of infections. So I took them, but I want to also make sure, I mean, what other foods might help? Like with cheese?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Relman, can you replenish it yourself?
Well, that's a good question. It looks as though it may be possible. And of course, it would be the foods that have live cultures as part of them. So yogurt is really one of the most obvious, but you can also buy tablets, of course, that have live bacteria in them. I think the one danger is that you don't want to go overboard. As they say, moderation in all things. And
right.
I think once we have a better idea of which particular organisms have the greatest benefit for each individual, we'll have a much better idea of how to go about doing this.
Thanks for calling. Here's a question from Second Life from Captain Webby, who says, what is the difference between the E. coli in our stomachs and the E. coli that makes us sick? We keep hearing about food contaminated with E. coli.
Yeah, that's a great question. The difference is basically a handful of genes. They're brothers and sisters in the same family, and the disease-causing organisms have picked up a group of genes that encode toxins, for the most part, and also adherence factors. And it makes those E. coli very different in their behavior, although they're ancestry is very similar to those of the health-associated ones in your gut.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we talk about the good bacteria versus the bad bacteria, I have been reading the literature over the years about the idea that may be in vogue with some doctors that if you can create a good colony, a very big colony of good bacteria, you can overwhelm and make yourself healthier the bad bacteria that might be in your gut. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think there are bits and pieces of truth there.
Mm-hmm.
And there is certainly the clear concept right now that by having a diverse and appropriate, whatever that means, appropriate community of bacteria in your gut, you can resist the invasion of a disease-causing organisms. It's a bit like an apartment building that's populated by a bunch of families of diverse types, and all the rooms are full, it prevents squatters from coming in and taking over the space. If you obliterate the normal inhabitants and there's empty space, and now we're talking almost in ecological terms, then organisms that otherwise couldn't do this will now enter and grow to large number and do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
How much of what we start out as infants do we inherit from our parents around us and possibly from breastfeeding of the bacteria?
It's a good question. It looks as though a lot of the organisms that become a part of us in adulthood were acquired early in life and even right at birth. And although that first year of life is almost chaotic from the point of view of who's there in your gut, there is a clear indication that early on the major sources are from your mom and from your dad and from the immediate environment.
Hmm. Let's go to Matt in Naples. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, I've taken the active yogurt when I was on antibiotics, and the thing that didn't make sense to me is how you can eat active cultures of bacteria, and they can make it all the way into your intestines getting through your stomach environment and everything without dying? How does that work?
Well, it's an interesting question, too. It's probably the case that they succeed by just virtue of their numbers. Some of them do die on the way through, and stomach acid is one barrier for certain organisms, preventing them from making their way down to the lower reaches of your intestinal tract. But yogurt and other live culture preparations are loaded with literally billions and trillions of organisms, and the idea is that enough make it through to reach favorable habitats, and they will then propagate.
It seems like from the questions you're raising and the research you've published and how surprising some of the results are, that you still have a long way to go to know what's happening in there.
Yeah, it's
humbling.
Deep, dark,
it's humbling.
It's humbling. You would think that at this point in our history, you know, scientific and intellectual history, that we'd have a better idea of who we are. But the funny reality is that we almost know more about the the jungles of the tropical rainforest in terms of their diversity than we know about the diversity within our intestinal tract.
Why would it be so diverse? I mean, are there just so many sources that are coming in that we're exposed to every day of our life? And
well,
we pick
again,
these things up?
I think a large amount of the diversity is picked up very early on, and it's maintained and allowed and even selected for because it's an intrinsic part of who we have evolved to be as living beings. It's not an accident. We need those communities. And they need us.
Right. I would imagine there's a lot of jostling and survival of the fittest in there going on.
Oh, absolutely. But there's also incredible altruism. These organisms will self-sacrifice left and right for each other and indirectly for us as the host.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one kind of bacterium will feed another. One will die in large number just so that a rare mutant can arise and fill a niche and provide a function that the others didn't have. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of altruistic behavior among bacteria as well as self-serving behavior as well.
We've talked a bit with other experts who look at bacteria in the soil, and they tell us 90% of the bacteria you can't grow in a petri dish,
which is
shocking itself.
That's right. In fact, when we began this work, our assumption on the one hand was that maybe this story would be the same, that just a teeny fraction would be recognizable as having been cultured before. Clinicians, on the other hand, said, oh, no, it's going to be different in there, meaning in our body, because hundreds of years of effort and much more familiar conditions will have led to successful cultivation. And the answer is someplace in between, that right now about half or maybe a little bit less of what we find using these molecular tools are organisms that we had never seen before, haven't yet been cultured, and are essentially novel.
And give us an idea of exactly what you do there.
We take specimens from the body as best we can, and we extract DNA, and then we sequence the DNA. And we look for the sequences that we can recognize as bacterial, and from those sequences basically recreate an evolutionary tree and ask, well, what are the branches? Who's there? Mm-hmm. What are they closely related to? Can we name them based on sequences we've seen before? And if not, who are their relatives?
Is it possible to have sort of a DNA fingerprint, a bacterial fingerprint of a person?
It's funny you ask because there are many people now who are wondering whether there's a new kind of biometric that could derive from our intestinal, but maybe even our oral microbiota. And this would be a biometric that not only says who that person is genetically, but also says who that person is in terms of their recent life experiences, where they've been living, what they do, who their pets are, with whom they spend time. And I think that's an important and open question. There may well be some signatures in our microbiota that can tell others who we are as people and as life forms on the planet.
Could they also tell who our family members are? Because we start out with the same.
And in fact, recent work by Jeff Gordon and others has suggested that the more closely related you are genetically, the more similar will be your microbiota.
And so what's the holy grail for you as someone who studies these bacteria?
Well, I think probably two bits. One is what's the nature of variation within these communities? from one site to another, at one site over time, and between individuals. And then the second bit is, what are these organisms really doing? And what are those functions that are intrinsic to serving in a symbiotic role with us? What is it exactly that they do for us, and what do we do for them, and how can we, you know, optimize and maximize those activities?
Mm-hmm. Just as a fact, I know, you know, it's a kind of research we don't ever think anybody's interested in.
Well, and it hasn't exactly been a popular funding topic until recently. And I have to say, NIH and now a lot of nations around the world have suddenly jumped on this idea of trying to define who we are from this particular perspective.
And where do you get your funding from?
NIH right now has a big initiative called the Human Microbiome Project. And then foundations, private foundations, have found this an area that has been underexplored and worthy of support.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Relman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your interest.
You're welcome. David Relman, Professor of Medicine and Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Veterans Affairs in Palo Alto Healthcare System. Up next, life at the extremes. The bacteria in your gut live their pampered life compared to the organisms. My next guest study, creatures that live in the world of extremes at the bottom of the ocean on those hydrothermal vents deep under the surface, one of the hottest and wettest places you can find. And on the other hand, those living in one of the coldest, driest places you can imagine, the dry valleys of Antarctica. So what do they have in common? Joining me now to talk about them is Craig Carey. He is Chief Scientist and Principal Investigator for Extreme 2008, a deep-sea adventure. He is Professor of Marine Biosciences in the College of Marine and Earth Studies at the University of Delaware, and he's aboard the Atlantis out there in the Pacific. Thanks for joining us.
You're more than welcome, Ira.
Also with us is Ian McDonald, a microbiologist at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. He's in the dry valleys of Antarctica. Our first satellite phone contact to the dry valleys. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. McDonald.
Hi, Ira. How are you doing?
Fine. When I was out there in the dry valleys about 30 years ago, they didn't have a satellite phone, so I'm glad to be able to talk to you. Tell us what you're studying there.
Yeah, it's great to have satellite phones. It keeps us in contact with not only people outside of the dry valleys, but our other workers in other dry valleys as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you studying?
So we're here looking at the microorganisms that are living in this very dry, very cold environment, and looking to see what indeed they're growing on down here.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Carey, let me just give a quick idea. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Craig Carey,
how are you doing?
Hi. What are you studying in on your boat there?
So for about the past 25 years, we've been looking at vents, and this is the sort of the first expedition that's actually begun to explore the predators of the bacteria that have become very famous in the hydrothermal vent systems. And so we're interested in looking at the diversity of both viruses, which are what we would call predaceous on bacteria, and small unicellular eukaryotic organisms, the protists, that would also be predaceous and grazing on the bacteria.
Dr. McDonald, do you think there is something in common in these both extreme places, you in Antarctica and Dr. Carey in those thermal vents, something about the life forms that keep them so robust?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The organisms that are living in the dry valleys and at these vents are both really struggling at the extremes and at the limits of their existence. So they're really struggling very hard to find food to grow on and conditions in which they're able to grow.
Mm-hmm. What kind of conditions are there in the dry valleys?
Well, at the moment, it's about minus 20 degrees centigrade, and there's obviously no available water at the moment because it's all frozen. And there are probably only a couple of months in the year in the dry valleys when there's water available for these organisms. Mm-hmm. And as we are led to understand that water is essential for life, so there's only a very short window when they can actually grow.
Mm-hmm. Ian McDonald, what are we talking about there in those hot vents?
Oh, the vents we have, it's a little bit almost the antithesis of the dry valleys. We have geothermal energy that is producing and providing a lot of chemical energy that these bacteria can harness. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we have a very dynamic thermal system. So we've got very, very hot water. I mean, water that will emit at the orifice of a vent at 360 degrees being ejected into a very, very cold deep ocean water that's probably around 2 degrees Celsius. So you've got this massive thermal gradient, and then the bacteria, as Ian has just said, are struggling to find that place within that gradient and within the confines of the toxicity of those gradients to make a home.
Now, you're headed to Antarctica after the hot thermal vent. You're going to these cold places. What do you seek to learn by being in these two places at once? Or actually different times?
Well, I mean, I think it all boils down to trying to understand what drives the biodiversity in these systems. What environmental conditions and parameters are actually enabling the organisms to live there, and then in turn, from a genetic standpoint, how they're able to adapt to these ecosystems. And I mean, the bacteria in the dry valleys are struggling with a whole set of rules that obviously don't pertain to the vents, and the vents obviously to the. But together, the adaptations are created in such a way that that they're, you know, there's a massive. Evolutionary thrust to adapt to these systems. And so what we're trying to do is just really understand how they adapt and what the mechanisms are for adaptation.
And you're about to go down in the Alvin.
Yeah, we're about a day and a half away from the Gulf of California, which is very different from where we just were. The Gulf of California has a high temperature hydrothermal vent system, but it's covered in mud. And so this is a very soft bottom system as opposed to the Nine North where we just came from, which is a hard bottom system. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually running a sort of a comparison in terms of the viruses and the protists. We're running a comparison between these two very very different geothermal systems.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. McDonald, you're finding life in the Dry Valley to be much more diverse than we once thought.
Yeah, absolutely. The early studies that were looking at the microorganisms down here believed that there were not very many and the diversity was very limited. But now that we're using molecular biology techniques to look at bacterial diversity, we're finding that there's a pretty huge diversity. The only question that we're trying to answer at the moment is what part of that diversity is actually showing any activity here? And that's a couple of the questions we're trying to answer over the next couple of years.
Whoops. I want to thank you both very much for taking the time to be with us. Ian McDonald, the microbiologist at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. He was in the dry valleys of Antarctica. And Craig Carey is chief scientist and principal investigator for Extreme 2008, a deep sea adventure. That's about all the time we have for this episode of Science Friday. If you'd like to surf over to our website where it's podcasting and blogging and Twittering, the new Twitter name is SciFry, if you'd like to enter that into your Twitter catalog. Have a great weekend. Great holiday weekend. Next week is our annual Thanksgiving Science Friday program with the Ig Nobel Awards. Hope you'll enjoy it. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.